talk about the polarization for a minute, okay?
I don't understand the seismographic data. I haven't studied it.
I don't know. It's very confusing. I'm an architect, not a seismologist.
The size of the dust, it is not powderized. It's not ultrafine. It's not even fine. We don't have ultrafine powder.
Well, we have furniture and computers and human beings and other living things turned to particles, Steve.
No, I'm sorry.
You know,
there
the first
are.
Responders that
again, we don't agree on that basic data.
Welcome to Field Interference. This is your host, Ryan G. Today I'm with Andrew Johnson, and we are talking about 9/11, about free energy, about Pons and Fleischmann, and what is cold fusion all about? And who wants to cover it up? And how does this tie in to the 9/11 cover-up? So, how are you doing, Andrew?
I'm doing fine, thanks, Ryan. How are you?
I'm great. I just came across recently, just in the past couple weeks, an interview between you and Dr. Judy Wood. And of all places, I was astounded to find that it was right on the dynamic duo with Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett, the boy wonder.
Okay. All right. Yep. That's correct.
Well, anyway, I found that Jim Fetzer didn't seem to enjoy at least the first interview too much, and I haven't heard his response on the second interview. But I must say that basically I found a lot of factual evidence to say that Jim Fetzer is covering up some information that he knows about 9/11.
Yeah, well, I would tend to agree with you on that, and maybe we can sort of go through the steps as to how one might arrive at such a conclusion.
Right. So how is it that Jim Fetzer came to know you and Dr. Judy Wood?
Well, speaking for myself, it was because of the Scholars for 9/11 Truth group that was formed in end of 2005, and I was invited to join that by Stephen E. Jones, and the message from him was CC'd to Jim Fetzer, who I think maybe known to some GMN listeners, because I know that Pete Santilli had a rather challenging, shall we say, to put it mildly, interview with Mr. Fetzer a few months ago. But I came into contact with him basically through email, I suppose you might say, because I'd been posting some information about 9/11. I think specifically what triggered it, I can't be absolutely sure of this, but I think it's probably correct. I was posting on a physics forum regarding the timing of the apparent free fall of the towers. And I later learned that the free fall, terminology is not quite appropriate. Because the towers didn't really fall, as has been discussed elsewhere on GMN, they turned to dust. But I'd posted around a particular short set of equations to do with the equations of motion, and I'd posted that on a physics forum. And I'm presuming, again, I have no proof of this, but somebody was sort of watching these forums for when these topics were coming up. And anyone who appeared to have a little bit of, knowledge and not be just talking nonsense was basically kind of, listed down somewhere, written down somewhere, and then they were contacted. And I know that Dr. Wood has told the story that she met up with David Ray Griffin, I think that was in 2005 as well. And she had suggested to him that some scholars could be, rounded up, as it were, quote unquote, to get involved with discussing 9/11 and so on. And so I think it was possibly the inspiration for forming the scholars group actually came from Dr. Wood. And that was before I'd come in contact with her. And so this scholars group was formed, and they began to put out press releases and post articles on websites, and it was formed by Stephen E. Jones and Jim Fetzer. And I've told this story quite a few times, and it's in my free ebook called 9/11 Finding the Truth, or some of it is, put it that way. And so by about mid 2006, various scholars were posting on forums, and we'd started discussing what happened to the towers, And Dr. Judy Wood had produced the billiard ball example, which is not a theory or a model. It's not meant to be a, you know, an analysis, particularly.
Right, it's an exercise.
Yeah, it's a thought experiment with numbers, you know, and putting some numbers to things.
Exactly, but also calculating numbers that are calculated in real physics books, just exercising that on the towers.
That's right. Sort of making that as a comparison as to what you might expect to have happened in a kind of, you know, very loosely based on the official scenario which was presented, which was this pancake collapse, you know, idea which had been presented. And I think
And as I understand it, Dr. Wood intended that exercise to simply give a rough estimate that would give you a good general number so that you could measure what actually happened versus what should have happened. And essentially, even if she was wrong by 10 seconds on her analysis in the end, it doesn't matter because it definitely wouldn't have taken more than a minute. It definitely did not take more than a minute for those towers to meet their demise.
Yeah, exactly. And that I think was what she was trying to illustrate, but using a kind of dispassionate, easy to understand example, which was also grounded, as you say, in a set of calculations, simple calculations, really, that you could visually verify just by looking at the videos of what happened, you know, if you'd kind of had a hazy memory of what you'd seen. And it was clearly anomalous. And but yet what puzzled me at the time when I came across this, it took me a while to realize, but this wasn't really being discussed on the scholars' forums very much. It was almost sidelined and marginalized. You know, it shouldn't have been, really, because it was actually a very good scientific thought process to go through to kick people off into unlocking the mystery.
As I understand it, it was instantly marginalized because even the no plane theory of Dr. Morgan Reynolds was accepted before Dr. Judy Wood. That at the Madison conference, as far as I know, they didn't want Dr. Judy Wood to speak, but they had Dr. Morgan Reynolds, and they also had Ace Baker, of all people, who honestly shouldn't be speaking to physical evidence. He should be only able to speak to video evidence, I guess, and that's even questionable at its base. But I would ask you, was it the case that I'm understanding correctly that Dr. Judy was instantly marginalized?
I think it was. Yeah, it was pretty much the case. And she was really sort of, she did several articles with Dr. Morgan Reynolds. And one of those was, did develop into a presentation that Dr. Morgan Reynolds gave at the Madison conference. But, Dr. Wood kind of, separated what she was doing from the plane issue. And as is in the, I think it's in the, well, it's in the early part of the book, Where Did the Towers Go? She does talk about the holes that the buildings received, that were made in the buildings, rather than sort of saying that planes crashed into them. She looks at the holes in the building and then leaves it at that, really. She doesn't really go beyond studying
the
anomalous nature of the holes.
She discussed the post-impact evidence of the planes. So, I mean, chose to attack.
Yeah, and then, of course, she was then, you know, said, she was coming out with ridiculous theories about there being known planes, and that, of course, was untrue, as most of the things like that that were said about Dr. Wood and her research were untrue. But I didn't really get a handle on that properly until early 2007, mid 2007. I was starting to get a handle on it then, because I'd seen these machinations going on the forum. And then there was this split between the two founders, Jim Fetzer and Stephen E. Jones. And then that Fetzer kept the name Scholars for 9/11 Truth, and Stephen E. Jones went off and formed his own group, which was called 9/11 Scholars for Truth and Justice. And they set up a different website, and it looked quite a lot slicker than FETS's. So I was quite suspicious that, you know, I was quite suspicious actually that the whole split had been engineered. I didn't quite fully bring that into my, you know, acute awareness, as it were, but it was all, the whole thing had very, much a feel that it had been a setup from the get-go. And between 2007 and 2008, I found out a bit more about Stephen E. Jones. You know, I knew he was this physicist from Brigham Young University. But I then found out from a video clip that I think Rosalie Grable had posted or sent me. I think it was her that sent me it. That Stephen E. Jones had done research into cold fusion. And indeed, he'd actually been one of the people that had helped to play down, or even, you know, that's putting it mildly, the play down the discoveries of Pons and Fleischmann. Stephen E. Jones was actually the person that coined the term cold fusion. I found out that a bit later, and I've got a recording of him actually describing that. It was Paul Palmer, who was a colleague of his, and Jones, that actually coined this term cold fusion. And at the time, Pons and Fleischmann came out with their, you know, their research, which they were kind of forced into doing because Jones was going to publish his own research on cold fusion, but they wanted to make sure that they were, recognized for the discovery of the phenomenon. And their phenomenon, which was, worked in a glass vessel, or a test tube, was completely different to what Jones had been working on. But Jones called it cold fusion, but their process was completely different. And so there was a lot of confusion in those times. And after a few months, Pons and Fleischmann actually, or particularly Fleischmann, was not happy that they were calling it cold fusion, because he didn't necessarily think it was nuclear fusion that was creating this anomalous energy. He came to understand that it was a nuclear process that was happening, but they weren't quite sure what that nuclear process was. It didn't seem to be, you know, real fusion for a number of reasons. But they were getting you know, the many people were reporting anomalous levels of tritium, which is something we can mention. It's a very important factor in these experiments. And this was clearly a very dangerous discovery for somebody, because John Bockris, who was a chemist working at electrochemist working at Texas A&M University in the 80s, late 80s and early 90s, he and a couple of colleagues repeated Pons and Fleischmann's experiments, and they were getting very high levels of tritium 2 out of 3 times they ran these cells.
As I understand it, John Bockris at Texas A&M was actually one of the main or key scientists in the cold fusion debacle that made one of the few scientists that made claims of tritium. The most of the claims that were being made were actually just neutrons or excess heat, but very few people were getting that transmutation effect of hydrogen, producing tritium, a radioactive isotope of hydrogen. And I did want to mention, I have right in front of me the book Fire from Ice by Dr. Eugene Maliv. And if you've never heard the name Dr. Eugene Maliv, I know you have, Andrew. Mm-hmm. Speaking to my listeners, if you've never heard the name Dr. Eugene Maliv, you need to read the book Fire from Ice. The subtitle is Searching for the Truth Behind the Cold Fusion Führer. Dr. Eugene Maliv worked for MIT News Office as a chief science writer. He found fraudulent claims in the tests done by MIT to disprove the claims of Pons and Fleischmann. When he reviewed the tests and found the evidence uncovered the exact opposite of what was claimed, he left MIT and began to write this book. He found that excess heat was found from a deuterium-palladium reaction, and yet nobody at MIT wanted to tell the truth. Why? Doctors John Bockrath at Texas A&M and Eugene Malov became avid critics of the vast critical cold fusion, anti-cold fusion movement. And basically people were saying that the nail was in the coffin, while Los Alamos was affirming that Pons and Fleischmann did see excess heat because many people are seeing the same effect from this deuterium-palladium reaction. And yet all seem to agree that this could not be accounted for in any known chemical reaction. And I just wanted to read a quote from Dr. Eugene Malov and ask you a question about it. Occam's razor is too easily forgotten. In science, the simplest unifying theory or connection is often most appropriate. Better to have a single explanation to bridge a host of apparently related phenomena than to concoct baroque excuses for why multiple independent experiments may all be systematically incorrect. Any possible nuclear effect, even a tiny suspected one, such as low levels of neutron particle emissions seemingly unconnected with heat production, should have been a tip-off that other puzzling and erratic effects in similar physical systems might also have something to do with nuclear phenomena. Use extreme caution in dismissing experimental results just because theory suggests they are impossible. Theory must guide science, but it should not be allowed to be in the driver's seat, especially when exploring the frontier. The fear that possible scientific error would be ridiculed, or worse, interpreted as fraud, is stultifying. A witch hunt against cold fusion affected researchers. Some who wanted to work in the field did not get involved for fear of scorn. Others hid positive results from colleagues, anticipating career problems, and some laboratory managers refused to allow technical papers to be published on positive results obtained in their organizations. Most incredible, some scientists publicly decried cold fusion while privately supporting its research. Now, that was a quote from Fire from Ice, searching for the truth behind the cold fusion furor. Please read that book if you get a chance. And now, Andrew Johnson, I'm pretty sure you've read that book.
I have, yes, yeah.
So, your opinion of someone like Stephen E. Jones is that basically he was putting a name on this reaction that he wanted to so badly put it in a box and marginalize it. Is that right?
Essentially, yes. I mean, I think it was basically part of the name cold fusion was part of an ongoing propaganda campaign to, you know, make sure that scientists were preloaded with the notion that cold fusion was something ridiculous by giving it that name, you know, this idea that because, and that of course was worked because all of the nuclear fusion research was based on something that was hot, very hot, you know, millions of degrees Kelvin in a something like a tokamak reactor. And, you know, billions or hundreds of millions of dollars had already been spent on these programs. And so to these sorts of, you know, scientists that had all the investment in their projects over the years, the notion that a couple of chemists, you know, not even physicists for heaven's sake, to come up with a nuclear process in a glass vessel on a tabletop was just highly ridiculous. So Jones essentially, I think, came up with this term because it would work well in or just by using that terminology, turning a lot of scientists against Pons and Fleischmann without them having to actually look at the research or anything or any of the other issues that you mentioned there in the statements from Eugene Malov or, you know, the work of people like John Bockrath. I think it was very carefully managed.
Hold that thought, Andrew. We'll be right back after this short break.
Hi, I'm Pete Santilli.
And I'm Susanna Cole, co-host of The Pete Santilli Show, broadcasting live worldwide Monday through Friday on the Rinse Network and Monday through Saturday on the Guerrilla Media.
Now, Stephen E. Jones, I wanted to ask, working for the Department of Energy and essentially being a child of the military-industrial complex, a term coined by Dwight D. Eisenhower, do you think that he had any motive in trying to marginalize the work of Pons and Fleischmann, and basically to not fully disclose to the public the amount of excess heat that could be seen from a non-thermal reaction?
Well, I think what his personal motive might have been is difficult to say, but if we look at it from the perspective of protecting the hot fusion program as one initial thing, you know, because of all the money that had been invested in it. In fact, I think Martin Fleischmann himself said that he realized that what they were putting forward was a big threat to the hot fusion program. I just don't think he realized how big a threat it was to that directly, because you're looking at two fields of research within the academic community. But going beyond that, of course, the promise of very cheap energy with little or no toxic byproducts, few or no toxic byproducts, was, of course, a big threat to the energy industry as a whole. And one can imagine that the way that government departments work and so on, you know, they're meant to be impartial. They're meant to be actors. Some of them meant to act as watchdogs for, you know, corporate entities. But the way that it works is you often get, you know, a revolving door between these government departments and large corporations. So we can see that information would very much is very likely to have been fed back from the likes of Stephen E. Jones back into the energy industry, so that they could then take their own steps, you know, pull the appropriate strings to make life difficult for Pons and Fleischmann.
And I think the most revealing of Pons and Fleischmann's results was the nuclear transmutation effect. And I just wanted to mention that it definitely was not just John Bockris from Texas A&M. You also had someone all the way from Japan, a very well-known scientist, Tadahiko Mizuno. He was born in 1945, and he basically had much experience in the field of electrochemistry and mistakenly came upon a nuclear transmutation in which almost destroyed his entire laboratory. And at first he was embarrassed about, and later found that no chemical reaction could account for what just happened in his lab. So he tried to recreate it. And he's done multiple presentations over the years with John Bockris. Now, with tritium being the transmutation effect, meaning that hydrogen, also with, I believe, one extra neutron, is called deuterium, right?
Right.
Well, a radioactive isotope of hydrogen is known as tritium, and there was a lot of tritium seen. Now, could it be that Stephen E. Jones is covering up the tritium results seen on 9/11?
Well, essentially, yes. I mean, the study, the Cahill study, which was done, the details of that are on Dr. Judy Wood's website and in her book, Where Did the Towers Go? That, as I understand things, showed that there was a roughly 50 times the normal level of tritium in water samples taken from near the World Trade Center. I'm not sure exactly where the water came from, you know, whether it was from directly where the buildings were or a few hundred yards away. But nevertheless, that there were 50 times the normal level of tritium in that water. And so this was a bit of a mystery as to where this amount of tritium could have come from. And the way that I understand things, based on what Dr. Judy Wood discovered in terms of the connection to what's called the Hutchison effect, which we can perhaps describe for people who are not familiar with this, is that both the Hutchinson effect and the what was called the cold fusion effect, but it is more correctly termed low energy nuclear reactions. By definition of that I've just said there, there is some type of nuclear process going on, which is not, at least in white world science, properly understood. This, I think, is what Jones was tasked with covering up, because they wanted to delay people finding out the significance of the tritium that was discovered in the water and the other effects that were seen in the evidence. And I think that's why Steve Nee Jones came out in 2005 as a 9/11 truther, quote unquote, because he came onto the scene within about a month or a few weeks of the World Trade Center reports being published by the National Institute. Okay, I don't know where that dropped off.
Okay, so what you're talking about here is very interesting and flows right with something I was about to bring up.
Right.
And I'll edit together this little part that we got right here. But So the interesting thing about what you're saying is that Stephen E. Jones, being one of the key scientists in many of the members of the 9/11 truth movement's eyes, not only had a motive to cover up things like low energy nuclear reactions, but while I was a freshman in college, I was following Alex Jones, and I just so happened to think that Stephen E. Jones was a very trustworthy scientist. And I took his study into a college class as a paper. I happened to get a chance to also interview William Rodriguez. So I wrote a paper questioning 9/11. It was the one paper that I could decide what I wanted to write about. So I chose 9/11. And when I was presenting, I made sure to mention that Stephen E. Jones had discovered the remnants of what appears to be thermite. And so I proceeded to blame thermite for all of the events that I heard about, what William Rodriguez told me about. I attributed thermite to so many parts of the 9/11 story of the destruction of the towers, and I basically was a full-on believer. It was not until 2011, about 3 or 4 years later, after finding out about Stephen E. Jones, that I found a woman by the name of Dr. Judy Wood on a coast-to-coast interview. I just so happen to not be able to find that coast-to-coast interview anywhere on the internet. But I thought that was a very good interview, and it made me question a lot of my own beliefs and possibly to possibly think that the men that I trusted so much, like Stephen E. Jones, may not be telling the full truth. Or they may not be aware of the full truth. So I personally needed to discover what the truth uncovered. And Dr. Judy Wood is the only one that I know that has produced a book that contains all of the forensic data necessary to understand the destruction or demolecularization of the World Trade Center towers on September 11th. And I wanted to ask you, Andrew, when did you feel that the members of the 9/11 truth movement decided they were going to ruin the persona of Dr. Judy Wood? When did you feel that that was set in stone, that there was no turning back, and the 9/11 truth movement as a whole has turned against the evidence?
Well, I mean, it was a sort of gradual progression for me. I mean, I was, you know, you described the process there, how you thought that thermite was responsible for most of the, you know, elements of the destruction and so on. I was pretty much in that position as well, you know, just to sort of line up with what you were saying, up until probably late 2006, about October, probably something like that. Around about October 2006, I'd begun to see enough of the ping-ponging that was going on to smell a rat, so to speak. And I think by early 2007, when, you know, we can probably mention this interview that was done with Dr. Greg Jenkins, which you will often, even now, you know, here we are from 2007 to 7 years later, very, very nearly, I think almost to the day, we're here, and people will still bring up this Greg Jenkins interview, claiming that this physicist, Dr. Greg Jenkins from Maryland, University of Maryland, debunked, quote unquote, Dr. Judy Wood's study, because of this ambush interview. And I ended up writing an article about this interview, which ended up in this free book that I put together, you know, which I published, in 2009, I think it was when I first published that. And, so, you know, it was really early 2007 when I began to realize that there was a smearing campaign against Dr. Judy Wood. And over the course of 2007, it became clear why there was this smear campaign, for two reasons. One is because she was right and she was telling the truth. And the other is because the implications of that truth, as you know, we've sort of talked a little bit of here, at least the beginnings of, were huge, in terms of this idea that we can get energy from somewhere, with a different type of process which doesn't involve burning fuel, you know, or having a fission, nuclear fission reaction. There's some other process going on which yields energy in some way, and that process, as a byproduct, creates tritium in various amounts, and it also creates, as you said, transmutation. And we should mention, I think, that transmutation of other elements and creation of other metals was also recorded in some of John Bockrich's experiments, and the, I can't remember the name of the Japanese chap that you'd mentioned. He also recorded, I understand,
that's transmutation. That's Tadahiko Mizuno.
Right, thank you. So yeah, I understand that he also recorded transmutation in his experiments, and that was one of the things I think probably he felt embarrassed to talk about, because it was that is directly, you know, discussed as a form of alchemy. And that would put any sort of chemist off, you know, as if you talk about that, then you're just going to be, you know, put locked up, because you're clearly not with it, you know. So, you know, I began to realize throughout 2007 that what Dr. Judy Wood had discovered was very important. And it was actually in February 2007 that I actually hosted two events for William Rodriguez. And he stayed at my house along with Annie Machon, the former MI5 officer. And I'd later
no
came
way.
To realize...
I met Annie Machon as well. Actually at a, I think it was called the Conspiracy Con or something.
Con, right.
But she came along with Jim Mars and a few other writers. And yeah, I mean, it was... I at first felt that I trusted some of these people. Now I wonder. I mean, what do you now think of people like Annie Machon or
Well, I can tell you my experience with her in that you know, the crunch for me with Annie Machon came. I'd known her since she got involved with talking about 9/11, which was, and I invited her and David Shaler. That's a whole other story, which would probably take an hour to sort of go into, but. So I sort of knew them, you know, not particularly well, but Annie Machon and David Shaler stayed at my house in 2005 when I organized an event in my home city of Derby, or I lived just outside Derby, which is in the Midlands. It's famous for, Derby is famous for Rolls-Royce engines, you know, that are used on some of the jumbo jets. So she knew me, you know, we sort of, I wouldn't say we were personal friends, but, you know, she had stayed at my house and stuff, and we'd exchanged a fair few emails and so on. And then she was still going around doing talks about 9/11, and I asked her, when she was doing talks about 9/11, if she could mention Dr. Judy Woods' Ketam case and just an outline of that, which was against the military industrial contractors who had been involved with developing the NIST reports or elements of them. And she refused. She refused to talk about this court case. She just point blank refused, claiming that it was all based on speculation, which of course was, it was ridiculous for her to say that, because you can't submit court documents into the court and then be speculation. They have to be based on evidence. So there was no speculation at all in that collection of documents.
Well, the evidence was coming from the NIST website, I believe.
Correct. Indeed, that's exactly where that's where a good proportion of it was coming from. Not all of it, because some of it had come from private photographic archives and so on. But that's essentially correct. So it was really challenging a lot of NIST's own evidence, and adding that to other evidence that was available from other scientific-based websites, such as U.S. Geological Survey and so on. And she refused to even discuss it.
As I understand it, the NIST contractors that were hired to analyze the so-called collapse of the towers actually hired a popularly known company called Underwriters Laboratory. Do you know them?
Yes, that's correct.
And
is
it true that there wasn't actually much to dispute other than the conclusion, because the tests done by Underwriters Laboratory actually proved that fire could not do that to steel. Is that correct?
That is correct. If you look at that report, which is on the NIST website, if you care to go and look for it, they built a scale model of one or two floors. I forget the exact details, but they, let's say for the sake of argument, you can go and check the exact details in the report, but they constructed a scale replica of the floors, two of the floors, and then they set it alight with an appropriate, set of materials, and let it burn twice as hot for twice as long, and none of the supports, melted or collapsed. Yet they signed off their report of saying that fire caused the collapse of those floors.
Now, this style of fraud reminds me very much of the story I introduced at the beginning of the show about Dr. Eugene Mallove finding that his own organization, MIT, had conducted tests and found evidence which supported the claims of Pons and Fleischmann of excess heat. And MIT decided to tell the world anyway that it did not find that, and that Pons and Fleischmann were not correct. Did you find that to be the case as well?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly an analogy there that, you've got sets of reports which take the data and then just present the opposite conclusion as to what the data actually shows is the truth. There is definitely, a comparison there to be made, in that when these official reports, are put out and they challenge some pretty basic assumptions which the establishment needs to protect as being true, then those reports will be, changed to be essentially to be fraudulent, so that it can protect the interests of those people. I mean, it goes on all the time, but this is perhaps just on a larger scale, because we've not only got the cover up of a crime and who did it, but also of effects that were seen in that crime, which are, caused by a technology which could change the world. That's the essence of why this is so important and why this is different.
The NIST contractors, SAIC, Science Applications International Corporation, and ARA, Applied Research Associates, they are manufacturers and or designers. At least they make prototypes of directed energy weapons, correct?
That is correct, yeah, absolutely.
Now, NIST hired these contractors to basically collect the core data, or at least analyze and interpret the core data that eventually became the final NIST report, correct?
Well, kind of. I mean, as I understand things, Science Applications International Corporation, if you look at the contract they were given, or what they actually contributed, allegedly it was more of a consultancy as to how to actually compile the reports. And it sounds ridiculous, but as I recall, the details for them is they actually helped some of the people who were preparing the documents insert the equations into the documents. That's one of the things that's listed in what they did, as I recall. So there's no reference to them providing any type of simulations or modeling, I don't think. I'd have to go and reread the contracts to be clear on that. But as I understand it, they were meant to have a kind of more role of coordination of the other contractors in compiling these reports and so on. However, with Applied Research Associates, they were employed to model the destruction created by the alleged plane crashes and develop computer models for the supposed failure of these beams following the alleged impacts. And that was what they did, but there was no mention made of the fact that they had a contract. I don't know if they've still got it, but they had a contract with the US government to know and be experts on directed energy weapons systems, you know, anywhere on the planet, basically. Chilling. What you gonna do, huh? What you gonna do? What you gonna do now? What you gonna do? What you gonna do? What you gonna do, huh? What you gonna do now? What you gonna do?